Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. This is Annika Smith broadcasting from the CSC in Seattle, and today we have here in our studios the privilege of having Denise O'Leary here. Denise is an award-winning Canadian author who wrote the groundbreaking By Design or By Chance back in 2004. And now, Denise, you have a new book out, The Spiritual Brain, which you say is a logical follow-up to By Design. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How is it following up to By Design or By Chance?
Well, first, I'm only the co-author. The lead author is a Montreal neuroscientist named Mario Beauregard. Basically, if materialism is true, then the mind is simply an illusion created by the workings of the brain. That is, in fact, what materialists believe. Mario, however, thinks that the evidence for that is not very good and argues that the mind exists independently of the brain. And not only that, but non-materialist neuroscience, such as he and others practice, depend on the mind not being simply an illusion of the brain, because when they treat people who have phobias or obsessive-compulsive disorder, they depend on getting those people to change their minds to the extent that they change the signatures in their brain. The brain, remember, is plastic. That is, it remolds in response to the amount of attention any given topic gets. So if people decide to just change what they think about, then some neural pathways will shrink and others will grow.
So the mind is having an effect on the brain.
Yes. In non-materialist neuroscience, the point is to get the person to agree to think differently, which means getting their mind to change their brain.
So it's an act of the will.
Yes. They have to decide to do it. If they don't decide to do it, it's not going to happen.
Wow. That's very powerful. There's a quote here from the book that says, there's no escaping the non-materialism of the human mind, that you can't get away from it, which is a real challenge to the materialist structure that we live in and that it seems most science operates out of, especially in the popular science literature and in the popular science press. You talk about how the press here has a lot to say on scientific issues. And one of the questions you ask is whether the popular science media were able to appropriately be critical of materialist discoveries that they seem to be making. You mentioned the God helmet, the God spot in the brain. I think the God helmet was probably the funniest one. I can't believe Richard Dawkins, I think, actually underwent that experiment to try to experience God by putting on a thinking cap.
I'm sure he was kidding. but many were not.
Right.
And the thing is, yes, what's really remarkable about the popular science press, which has a vested interest in materialism, is the sheer folly of the things that people were prepared to believe.
Mm.
That spiritual experiences were caused by temporal lobe seizures.
Mm.
That this God helmet sponsored by a psychologist up in Sudbury, Ontario. Do you have any idea where that is?
No.
believe me, it's remote. And that you could put that on and that, rather than psychological suggestion, was the cause of spiritual experiences. It was interesting to reflect on the sheer ignorance and inability of people to actually even understand what they were saying.
Mm.
What would have to be true for that to be true? So that was certainly an education for me. I hadn't gotten into this side of things. I had been studying the intelligent design controversy and various environment issues and health issues and so forth. But when I got into it, I was really quite surprised. But it's easy to understand in a way. The popular science media people would never, for the most part, with a few exceptions, have considered the possibility that materialism might not be true. As far as they're concerned, science is the business arm of materialism.
Right.
Its purpose is to prove materialism.
Which is why they seek only materialist answers. At one point, I think you wrote that materialists are compelled to search for materialist explanations for these religious experiences and mystical. What's the acronym you have for them?
We call them religious, spiritual, and mystical experiences because very often an experience could participate in all three, or it could be only one.
Mm.
But what we don't want to get bogged down any more than William James, a century ago, wanted to get bogged down in trying to create ironclad, tight compartments. So we said, now, mystical experiences are not the same thing as spiritual experiences. Again, not the same thing as religion, but they're all part of a complex, so we just called them RSMEs when we wished to speak generally. But we spoke in a clearer, more focused way when we want to talk about a specific thing.
And you say that these RSMEs and the neuroscience of it actually suggests God? I mean, you're not saying that it can prove God.
Oh, heavens.
Right.
God can't be made the subject of neuroscience research.
Exactly.
All that we did in the book, presenting Mario's research on Carmelite nuns and other people's research, and surveying the history of research into these issues, materialist and non-materialist, was to come to the conclusion that the most reasonable explanation for what was happening was that people do contact a power outside themselves. That's the most reasonable explanation. We can't prove it. It's actually never possible to prove that anyone is having a subjective mental experience. Exactly. I don't just know how you would go about it. What we can say is, what is the most reasonable way to interpret things? And that is the conclusion we come to.
Which is why the subtitle is a neuroscientist's case for the existence of the soul.
Yes.
Okay. Now, the original subtitle I saw was actually How Neuroscience is Revealing the Existence of God.
Okay. That was a mistake on the part of someone at the publisher. We had never seen the book that way. We don't really get that much into talking about God. As God, right? What we're talking about is people's religious, spiritual, and mystical experiences, which point to the existence of God or a cosmic...
A reality outside
reality, yes, that outside ourselves that creates meaning and purpose in the universe.
So this is such a radical departure, I guess, because most neuroscience, and you even mentioned Tom Wolfe's 1996 essay, Sorry But Your Soul Just Died, because most materialists and the ones that he cite when they were getting into neuroscience, especially back in the 1990s, were getting very excited about how we were explaining these materialist answers for the God spot in the brain, for the God gene, for everything going on inside our brains. And I just want to read this quote here. This is Jesse Baring. This is from the latest John Brockman. Have you seen this? He's the...
What is your non-dangerous idea, right? What is your idea that would put to sleep everyone in the faculty lounge?
Oh,
you want to state a dangerous idea. Say something like, I think the best way to interpret my research is that the universe shows evidence of intelligent design. That's dangerous. What these people are doing, John Brockman, the Edge, Wedge the Edge... All I know is, it's not dangerous, it's dull.
It's
passé, it's so yesterday, it's not where things are.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction. I have a very dull, then, quote for you.
Go ahead.
on the idea of God. It says here, Jesse Baring, his dangerous idea, science will never silence God. This is because God is not an idea, this is a direct quote from him, nor a cultural invention, nor an opiate of the masses, nor any such thing. God is a way of thinking that has been rendered permanent by natural selection. I mean, this is what the materialists are coming up with for how we have God and the problem of God, why people have been believing in religion and have been seeking these mystical experiences as long as we've been people. What does your book say in response to this?
Well, first off, we need to understand why someone would say that. What the materialist needs to do is to explain the human mind and any contents thereof in materialist terms. This guy has chosen natural selection. Somebody else might choose the selfish gene. or postulate the existence of some nonsensical concept like the meme or whatever. So it really doesn't matter what it is he's postulating as long as it isn't that the mind is real.
Mm.
Now, that's the dangerous idea. I think that in our book, we talk about that, certainly, and we have to go back behind ideas about God to understand what the conflict is between materialism and non-materialism. See, trying to understand consciousness itself is like looking into and out of a window at the same time, because consciousness is subjective and it's objective. For me, your consciousness is objective and mine is subjective, and for you, it's the reverse.
Right.
That doesn't mean it can't be studied, but it does mean that if we are looking for some way to show that consciousness doesn't really exist, is a user illusion, is simply generated by the random firings of neurons, yada, yada, we're wasting our time. A more likely explanation is that mind creates matter than that matter creates mind. But, of course, the materialist is wedded to matter creates mind, and therefore he needs to espouse virtually any concept other than that the mind is real. So I'm not surprised by this Jesse Bering's quote. I think if you look, you'll find that there are 50 others that are similar, except that each of them will be reaching for a different ornament on the Christmas tree.
You write about materialism and you call it a monistic philosophy. Can you unpack that a little bit and explain what a monistic philosophy is and how this affects the way scientists approach,
well,
how the limits it imposes on science? Let's put it that way.
A monistic philosophy is a philosophy according to which there's only one thing, in this case, matter. Now, one of the problems with a monistic philosophy, as opposed to a dualistic one, is the monist, the follower of a monistic philosophy, must prefer any explanation within his philosophy, no matter how defective or ridiculous, to any explanation outside it. In the case of materialism, dealing with matters like consciousness, mind, spiritual experiences that change people's lives, self-sacrificing behavior for people one doesn't know, the materialist is forced into very defective explanations that must be treated as if they were fact, because otherwise he would have to acknowledge the existence of non-material fact, which he's unwilling to do. So you will hear people insist that God is a gene, God is a circuit in the brain, temporal lobe epilepsy,
right,
this, that, the other, I don't know. There were times I lost track. There were times I laughed so hard I had to be very careful not to be drinking coffee or anything while I was working. But part of the background of that is that I myself come from a background where spiritual experiences were taken for granted and were known to very frequently be life-changing. So I don't mean I came from a fundamentalist background or anything like that, but I was familiar with a good deal. So when I heard these explanations and thought them not only wrong but ridiculous, I realized this is all these people have to offer. Now I know that we're in the middle of a big change in the way people are thinking.
So you would call this a shift?
Yes.
Wow.
Very much so. Because materialism isn't delivering the goods. For example, you see, many people can't put it together yet, but they will. For example, it was discovered a few years ago that the drugs that were used to treat depression, and that was the basis of Tom Wolfe's statement, "Sorry, your soul just died." What he was talking about was drugs like Prozac and Zoloft. Well, lo and behold, Prozac and Zoloft were found in many studies not to perform nearly as much better than placebos as anybody thought they would. Because it turned out that the primary substance that was being marketed in a great many cases, as we say in the book, was hope. Hope for actual treatment of depression. This is so true of many, many situations in medicine. When I started to study it, I discovered, for example, that in one study, men who didn't take their placebos for heart problems were more likely to die than men who did.
And this is with the sugar pill, with the placebo.
We're not talking about something that's an actual treatment. In another study, the treatment started to fail to work when doctors stopped believing in it, even though it had never been an effective treatment. Because what people think has a very great effect on their physical health, which isn't very surprising if you assume that the mind is real.
Mm.
It's a major conundrum. In fact, New Scientist magazine called it one of the biggest mysteries. Of course, if you're a materialist, the placebo effect is a big mystery. If you're not, it's not a mystery. It's simply the fact that the instructions the mind gives to the brain and subsequently to the body have a very great influence on health.
So what does this mean for healthcare? Where would a non-materialist science, non-materialist medicine move then?
Well, it does open the way to promising treatments. Many mental disorders are relatively intractable because if you can't get the person to change their mind voluntarily, it's difficult to treat the disorder. You can give them medications. Medications have side effects. They're expensive. They may not take the medications, or they may take them inappropriately or not on schedule. This causes all kinds of trouble. If you could get them to change their minds, as Mario and some of his colleagues, like Jeff Schwartz, have done, you can show much more consistent health benefits. Mario and his colleagues were he was one of the people in the study, but the two lead authors were colleagues of his. They got women who were spider phobes, whose lives were dominated by fear of spiders, to change their minds to the extent that they were willing to touch an enormous live tarantula.
Oh, my.
And you see, they showed that their brains had changed in the process.
Wow.
Now, at first, I wondered how serious can spider phobia be. Then when I was talking to a colleague about it, the colleague told me something interesting. The colleague revealed an intention to move to a remote community in a place that's too remote to have spiders, because this person's life had been very much affected by fear of spiders. So I had had no idea of any of this, and I suppose it's embarrassment that would cause a person not to say anything.
To hide, right.
And I thought, gee, I wish this person had been in that study.
Mm.
But so, yes, non-materialist approaches can help. Similarly, if you could reduce the amount of antidepressants a person needs to take, another non-materialist issue that's quite important is people who have had near-death experiences, according to Pim Van Lommel's statistics from his fairly extensive study, are considerably more likely to die in the 30 days following the experience while they're in post-operative phase than people who have not had one. Now, one reason may be that a key consequence of a near-death experience is the person loses their fear of death.
Mm.
You know, a near-death experience,
right,
where they seem to be out of the body and often feel they're talking to people who are dead and maybe talking to God or something. Well, it's significant that they're so much more likely to die. This is probably, I expect, because they're not trying very hard. Many say, I had a hard time deciding to go back. I was having such a good time. So another way that non-materialist neuroscience can help is the non-materialist isn't concerned to try to prove that the person didn't really have that experience, that it's just a delusion or something. You can assume, yes, he had the experience. Now, he didn't die. So how are we going to help this person adjust to life?
Mm.
As opposed to becoming another post-operative statistic. That's just one example. Again, as I get more into it, I see many ways that non-materialist ideas can help. Oh, here's another one. Many treatments actually depend on the person's belief to a very great extent.
Oh, really?
Yes. That's what the placebo effect basically shows. Not all treatments, but a number.
So their belief on whether or not they'll be well.
Mm. Now, that has a major impact in two highly controversial areas. Embryonic stem cell research. Some studies have shown that people got better if they thought they were getting embryonic stem cells, whether they were or not, probably because they had been conditioned to believe that they were more potent than some other treatment.
Oh, wow.
Now, if that's true, to the extent that such a treatment depends on the placebo effect, to that extent, it would be useful to establish how much, because if there is a moral issue around the use of stem cells from human embryos abandoned at fertility clinics,
right,
then it may be very helpful for people to know that actually most of the people who got better, there might not be much of a distinction between the people who got better thinking they were doing it and the people who got better who were doing it. If that's true, it's important. I mean, when you consider the amount of public controversy over things like this, well, then another area concerns environment issues. Animals like tigers and bears are killed because of beliefs that their organs of their body will help men who have sexual problems. See, as a Westerner, I'm inclined to dismiss it as superstition.
Right.
But is it? What if the main thing is an enormous placebo effect? Suddenly he finds himself thinking as he didn't think before because he got hold of what he thought were tiger parts. Now, in terms of preventing the tiger from becoming extinct, what we need to see here is he's not wrong about the effect. He's wrong about the cause. The cause is in his own mind. So that's another way that non-materialist neuroscience can help. His mind is not an illusion. It's actually directing the process. If he could get himself to see that it was always all in his mind and use that, then the tiger could live in peace in some eastern jungle and no one would ever need to go and kill the tiger in order to have a happier marital life, right? Well, so I gather in so many cases, it's really amazing. It's unfortunate after we'd written The Spiritual Brain, I got hold of a very interesting book detailing all the studies of the placebo effect that this anthropologist was aware of. I think his name is Daniel Mormon. And he talked about how, you know, all these situations, and I remember thinking, there's a huge area in here just waiting to be opened up. And as I say, there are significant areas that could actually be helped. Now, I have a theory, for what it's worth, about why the placebo effect has been so neglected, despite its power. Remember, a drug has to show itself 5% better than the placebo effect to be licensed for use. But what does that mean? It means a whole lot of people are going to get better just because they believe they are. And therefore, you have to prove that the drug is at least 5% better than that, which means that's fairly powerful in many cases. So, now, many major innovations in the 19th and 20th centuries did not depend on the placebo effect. For example, vaccination, antibiotics, defibrillation. For the most part, these interventions will work whether the person believes they're going to work or not. A person who receives the polio vaccination will not get polio. If they think they're going to get polio, they may develop some of the symptoms of polio. That's the nocebo effect, the evil twin of the placebo effect. But they won't, in fact, get polio. Now, I think what happened was that many people began to assume that the way medicine should work is like that. That doesn't matter what the patient thinks. You just have to give this drug or that injection or do this operation and things will be fine. Lots of medicine isn't like that. In many cases, people are managing chronic illnesses or lifelong disabilities or lifelong tendencies to a problem like depression. And placebo effects or nocebo effects, the evil twin, become very important. And then you need to look into the effect that the mind is having on the brain and the body. Because in that case, well, like you can give the person the antidepressant, and it doesn't appear to be working. Or they decide to flush it down the toilet and jump off a bridge. Well, you see, again, if you're not contacting their mind,
you're not going to change anything.
You're not going to change anything. You can't just give them a pill and tell them, get out of my office, now you're cured.
Wow. Well, I think that's all the time we have for today's podcast, but thank you, Denise, so much
You're
for
welcome.
Sharing from your new book, The Spiritual Brain. For ID the Future from the CSC here in Seattle, this is Annika Smith. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.